Have you noticed when we, the ordinary people, are being oppressed, leaned on by the high and mighty, we can very easily resort to feeling helpless and oppressed and mistreated, rather than stopping for a minute to analyse just who is being manipulated by whom? That sort of thing is going to affect our behaviour and response to the situation. It may be less than we would wish. And it's going to shape our peace in the situation to hand. Now, there are larger considerations to be borne in mind in a situation like that, although it can be hard to get hold of them at the time. And that is the message of our passage today in the book of Esther, chapter 3, verses 5 to 15. What we've got going on here is a man's response to somebody not bowing down and kowtowing to him. So first of all, Haman's fury is detailed for us in verses 5 to 6 of Esther chapter 3. Here's how it goes. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honour, he was enraged. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of only killing Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. Wow. Genocide, and we're only in chapter 3. What do you read into that situation that's just been described for us there? You see, this is a story, a drama being worked out before our mind's eye, and we're supposed to use our imagination to understand what's going on to inform our understanding of the world and our experience. So standing back and thinking it over, what do you see here in this man Haman's response when Mordecai won't bow down to him and pay him honour, obeisance? Well, I think what I see here is a little man inhabiting a big man's position in politics. We've seen already he's a bit of a social climber, this Haman, working his way in to get prestige and honour by currying favour at the court. But favour at court and honour are not really the same thing, are they? You can work your way in and be very dishonourable in how you live your life, gaining favour where honour is not due. So here, when he is not bowed down to by someone who deserves to be honoured, Mordecai, but hasn't been honoured, because do you remember he saved the life of the king and then was passed over? When he's not bowed down by to a person who deserves honour but hasn't been honoured, Haman throws a total hissy fit and overreacts completely. He scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. That is not, clearly not, the act of a big man. It's the vengeful, insecure response of a man who doesn't amount to much but has wheedled his way into power, risen to such a height that he can't even contemplate looking down in case he falls. He's not secure enough to just have a word with Mordecai to see if they can sort it out. Drunk on power, but unsteady on his feet, Haman decides he's going to obliterate Mordecai's race. Odd, isn't it? How so many autocratic rulers have been men of small stature. Well, this malice, secondly, is a slow, simmering malice on the part of Haman. Verse 7. Esther had been queen for 5 years when Haman brought his malicious accusation. Esther 3:7. In the 12th year of King Xerxes, in the first month, the month of Nisan, the pur, that is the lot, was cast into the presence of Haman to select the day and month. And the lot fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar. Haman, like many insecure people, I guess, was a superstitious man, a superstitious human being. So he casts the lots. Now, of course, there are people of biblical faith in the Old Testament who also cast lots to discover God's will. In those Old Testament days, the Holy Spirit had not been given at Pentecost in the way Joel 2 prophesied that he would. So Joshua cast lots before the Lord to work out, to discover how to divide the land between the tribes of Israel, very famously in Joshua 18, verse 6, and so on. But what matters at that point, in the developing history of God's relationship with his people, is who you are casting lots before. Here, and it's the only time in the Bible, the Hebrew word pur is used. The Hebrew word Purim, we later learn in the book, is the name given to the Jewish festival that celebrated the deliverance that finally comes to God's people at the end of the book. But the usual word for these dice, by which the propitious course of action was discovered, is goral. And there's plenty of that being thrown around, as it were, in the Bible. It's perfectly legitimate in those Old Testament times when it is the God of the Old Testament whose will is being sought by his pre-Pentecost people. The important thing is who you are trying to get answers from. Well, Haman wasn't trying to get answers from the God of the Bible. And the other thing to notice here is that whilst Haman starts casting lots in the first month, the month of Nisan, when the Jews celebrate the Passover, they continue to cast lots about this day after day, month after month, and it's the 12th month, the month of Adar, before they get the indication from the forces behind pagan Persian religion that now is the time to move against Mordecai's people, God's people as we know them to be. This was a simmering, settled malice. Verse 7. Well, when he got the result that he wanted, Haman approached the king in verses 8 to 9. A certain people are brought to the Persian king's attention. And those singled out people are characterized as both at the same time inconsequential people and a threat. There's a really well thought out bit of monarch manipulation going on here. And that manipulation has the ear of the king. But just as with Menuchin and the monarch in Esther chapter 1, the manipulation going on here is clear and tangible. It is clever, but it isn't good. The people to be persecuted are characterized carefully as a threat to the power the king cherishes, but which the king has so publicly, so recently failed to maintain. In the campaign, he's summoned his clients to put so much time into, so much energy, so much effort for the conquest of Greece. A campaign that has for the second time quite recently failed spectacularly. And Haman plays on the security of the king and his consciousness of the state of the royal finances. There's a people that Haman wants to see wiped out. Because Mordecai, who is one of those people, hasn't pampered Haman's ego. So Haman first characterizes and isolates these people to build prejudice against them. First of all, he says they are scattered. Well, if they're scattered, they're going to be vulnerable, inconsequential people. But they're being characterized as those with tentacles everywhere at one and the same time. And the idea is being built that they could be a threat. Just think of people groups that have had opinion dangerously turned against them in modern history by being first characterized in this way. Vulnerable people, but with tentacles threatening everywhere. Firstly, they're scattered. Secondly, they don't fit in. Don't fit in. Haman convinces Xerxes that these people are dangerous to the unity of his empire. A unity threatened by the stresses caused by the losses the empire's client kings have suffered in the wars, simply because this people, being stigmatized, don't fit in. Here's how. They're characterized as separatist, different, and disobedient, a threat to the unity of the state they see. Firstly, they keep themselves separate. Now, here's a perennial snag. You know, I was at a Christian meeting this week where the suggestion was being made that people would understand what Christianity was about better if Christians didn't refer to themselves as Christians, but as followers of Jesus. And just in quiet discussion with a brother afterwards, I ventured the view that whilst that might work well in other cultures, I had in mind the southwestern states, perhaps the USA, to do that in our culture here was almost guaranteed to be misunderstood. Because I'm a follower of Jesus would stand out as being weird. And somebody said, but as Christians, we're supposed to be weird. Now, hold it there. Because as far as Christian living in our world is concerned, there's a right and a wrong sort of weird, isn't there? I tend to think it's the right sort of separate the author of Esther has got in mind here, because there is such a strong theme of covenant going on in this book at this time. And it was one of God's covenant stipulations that his people should be separate from the other nations and consecrated, set apart for him. But that's going to be counted, an accusation, if you like, against God's people. If you're coming at it from Haman and King Xerxes' perspective. Firstly, they keep themselves separate. Secondly, their customs are different. You see, Haman is saying, keeping themselves separate, that's not all that threatens your position of power here. Their customs are different from the ones we seek to unite our lovely empire with. Customs. Unity. Well, insecure rulers, they seek to bolster their power with a unified culture. It's been the case throughout history that unity and diversity has characterized the kingdom of God. But insecure despots have sought to impose cultural uniformity in the assumption that this constitutes societal unity. Those are two cracking arguments to play on Xerxes' sense of insecurity and the political situation he's wrestling with. But Haman's stinger has been saved up till last. Thirdly, he says, they obey their own laws. They don't fit in. They obey their own laws. Now then, these people, that he still hasn't called by name, by the way, keep hold of and obey their own laws. This strikes a blow, or would be clearly perceived to, at the heart of the Persian state. If he hadn't been already persuaded, Xerxes by now would be soundly on side with Haman on all this. And then Haman puts the king next of all. A consolidation of the already stated arguments. These people don't fit in. They don't fit in. They are scattered. And this situation is not in your interests. That's the third thing, it's not in your interests. Well, from everything we already know about Xerxes, he would be supremely well motivated by his own personal interest. He is a self-centered person in power. He's that dangerous feature on the face of humanity, a leader who can't say no to himself. So yes, nicely played, Haman. Their laws are different from those of every other people. They do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. That's Esther 3, verse 8. And now Haman goes on from that point. It's not in your interest. He removes the king's most pressing problem for any consideration of this evil proposition. Haman says, and I'll give you money. Do this and I'll give you money. Verse 9, I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasuries. Well, we know that Xerxes was short of money because of his expensive campaigns that had failed in Greece. And we know that he's going to be limiting what he does because he hasn't got the spons, as it were, to crack on. So Haman says, this is what I want. This is why you should do it. Definitely in your interest. And by the way, here's a large wad of cash to enable this to happen. So fourthly then, what was the king's response to all of this? Verses 10 and 11. So the king took his signet ring from his finger, gave it to Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. Keep the money, the king said to Haman, and do with the people as you please. What's going on here? Well, I was puzzling that through and I couldn't quite get my head around it, so I did a bit of sweating with the Hebrew here. I reckon the English Standard Version, which sticks really closely to the text here, gives us a bit more of a clue as to what's going on. And the king said to Haman, says the ESV, the money is given to you, the people also, to do with them as it seems good to you. What money? The money Haman has just said he'll give the king, which is far more than is going to be expended in publishing the king's edict and in executing the command that it carries. The silver, the money, is given to you, says the Hebrew. This money Haman has promised is the only money in the context, so it is that money. Right, okay. Now just consider, if you would, the historical context that drops into. "We," No, just said, "the king is pretty fresh back from his military campaigns in Greece that had led up to the disastrous Battle of Salamis, the disaster befalling Xerxes, which concluded the Second Persian War. And we know that because of that, Xerxes is very much short of funds at this particular point in time." And it looks as if Haman's offer of a huge sum, far more than needed for the task he wishes to see accomplished, recognises that Xerxes I is having to cut his cloth very much according to his empty pocket. And Haman is promising to cover the costs of his plan for the genocide of the Jews, probably quite a bit left over. And so knowing that the costs entailed are covered, the king most unhesitatingly says, "The money is given to you or for you and the people or nation to do with it for them as is pleasant to your eye." It's as if Haman has been very sensitive to the fact that the king is impecunious, out of money, and therefore needs to minimise government interventions of all sorts. But now that Haman is putting up the sponsorship, Xerxes will be happy for this to happen, and he hands over the financial gift of Haman and the people or nation that Haman wants to clobber to do to them whatever pleases your eye. Now, of course, I'm not a great Hebrew scholar, and I've seen this idea in none of the commentaries, but I've sweated over the words on the page, and I've used my imagination to try to enter into what's going on in the story. I reckon what's going on is that Haman has made it easy for the king to do what he's asking the king to do, presented a solution, not a problem, and thereby manipulated this powerful but poor despot to favour Haman, the Agagite's, evil plan. And that's what underlies the king's response. So the king took his signet ring from his hand, gave it to Haman, the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, "The money's given to you, the people also, to do with them as it seems good to you." Now, what happens next is Haman, he does not hesitate for a minute. But fifthly, he positively leaps to put his evil plan in action. Verses 12 to 15a, administering the malice. Verse 12 tells us, "Then on the 13th day of the first month, the royal secretaries were summoned, and they wrote out in the script of each province and in the language of each people all Haman's orders to the king's satraps, the governors of the various provinces, the nobles of the various peoples. These were written in the name of Xerxes himself and sealed with his own ring." You see, Haman had waited 11 months consulting their pagan gods for the propitious day. But immediately he sent out the decree sealing their fate. Ironically, get this, on the very day before Passover, he did it on the 13th of Nisan. Passover is the 14th. And the decree sent out orders all Persian citizens to take up arms on the appointed day and slaughter their Jewish neighbours, regardless of their age or their gender. And that decree is sent right throughout the empire to every inhabitant in their own language. Now, the malice of that is highlighted as Haman is again referred to in terms of the ancient enmity. Verse 10, "The king took his signet ring from his finger and gave it to Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews." The Agagites were, we've seen this before, in this habitual and long-running historical enmity with the Jewish people. So now the mass citizenry of the Persian Empire is about to come down on the people of God because Haman's pride led him into such great malice. That's the thing to notice here. We see this in the world around us. Haman's need to be honoured and shown outward respect cuts up rough. Very like the situation in chapter 1, where Memucan's unmoderated need for honour and respect as the man in the home motivates the king's decree that wives throughout the empire should respect their husbands. It really seems that Menuhin's fear of losing respect at home led him to stir up the situation between Xerxes and Vashti, his previous wife, sending the issue reverberating through every part of the empire. And now the failure to show commanded respect by one Jew, Mordecai, sends a murderous edict against all the Jews reverberating throughout the entire Persian empire. And it all leads Karen Jobes to comment in her commentary. "A sub-theme of the Esther story is that when such maniacal need for honour and respect is coupled with absolute power, the result is oppression and injustice. People this maniacal, this manic like need for honor and respect mixed with absolute power, it really does result in oppression and injustice. And it's coming down in Esther 3 on all the people of God. If Mordecai had been honored properly at the time that Mordecai should have been, because he followed the plot against the king, do you remember that? Followed the plot against the king, but really wasn't honored, while Haman instead was. If that hadn't happened, then Haman would not have been able to rise to power and perpetrate this further gross injustice against Mordecai and the Old Testament people of God. The injustices against God's people are piling high by now. Both Esther and Mordecai, though, are in this position because of the injustice and wickedness of others. And they can't see what lies in the future for them. So they have no idea that the position they've been brought to is one that is going to enable them, this very position is the very one that enables them to become the future deliverers of their people in God's good providence. That's why they're in this situation, which looks so bad, but that God means for good. Remember the words of Joseph to his brothers in Egypt when they came down there and he revealed himself to them and all that had happened? They thought they'd killed him and they hadn't. He said, yes, you did this, but God meant it for good. Well, Haman had cast lots to discover from his pagan Persian gods how to get what Haman wanted. And that's what pagan worship seeks, and that's how paganism works. It's about how to get what a person themselves wants in so many ways. But Proverbs 16:33 helpfully teaches us, the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. Haman cast the lots to discover the best date to annihilate the Jews, but the Lord had already determined and promised in Exodus 17:8-15 that after the Passover he would save his people from being destroyed by the Amalekites. That's Haman's people. The Agagites were part of the Amalekites, you see. God would save his people from being destroyed by those people from generation to generation. And Haman's plot to wipe out the Jews on Passover Eve, the celebration of deliverance from Egypt, which was going to get thwarted, would be deeply ironic. There's a biblical history, you see, to threats against God's people. History shows that there is a force at work in the world bent on the destruction of God's people, working through Egyptian pharaohs, Agagite sons of Amalek, and Roman emperors too. In the Roman Empire, many believers laid down their lives, many Christian believers by then, because their allegiance to Christ was viewed as a lack of respect shown on their part to Rome's emperors, who demanded that whatever a person's personal faith, they should burn a little incense publicly to the imperial gods to demonstrate respect for the authority of Rome. Now, life under worldly rulers can to this day be precarious for those who acknowledge God's supreme sovereign authority, where it is not in the king's best interest to tolerate the people of God. And Revelation, the book of Revelation at the end of the Bible, fills in the cosmic background to this theme in world history with its account of the beast in Revelation 13. Worth a read if you have the time and want to understand the background to the perception of the people of God across history and in the present day of how human pride and the demand for obeisance, doing honour, made by insecure people in positions of power, serves the destructive purposes of the enemy of souls. But Revelation, Esther 2 in its own unique way, goes on to show that above and beyond all this work of the force that is opposed to God and his people, the evil force that demands to be respected, there operates an even greater force, a greater power, the power of the Almighty, that actually directs the entire course of human history and is powerfully at work to save and redeem God's cause and God's people. And we see it supremely, of course, in Christ, who, Colossians 2:15, having disarmed the powers and authorities, he made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them by the cross. Right there on the cross was where he won. Amazing, isn't it? When he was suffering most, when he was so openly despised and rejected, when he seemed most thoroughly vanquished and defeated. What, a crucified Messiah? His cross formed the steps back up to his throne. and bought the redemption of his people. And all the while, the Haman types in his world had no idea what it was they had done. But even amongst those looking on, their actions breed perplexity and confusion. And that's precisely where this episode concludes in Esther 3. Because the conclusion in verse 15b of Esther chapter 3 is a conclusion of contrasts. A very revealing one. Verse 15b, and the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. There's a real punch to the way this episode concludes there. Firstly, the response of the citizens of Susa. The people of the city of Susa, this capital, this moving capital of the Persian Empire, but this is one of the ones. It was a winter one because the summer was far too hot to be there. The people of this city of Susa then, hearing about this stuff that Haman and the king had done, were stunned and perplexed. Now, some translations go with the word bewildered. They fell into a state of complete confusion. This edict against these small, scattered, vulnerable-looking people in the empire. This tribe, I suppose, they would have been looked at. This final statement of verse 15, it's a sad commentary on the pathetic disregard of despots for the human misery and suffering they sometimes inflict on those who are helpless to resist their power. And here, while common people braced for the reckless loss of life and property that was about to begin in bewilderment and confusion, the perpetrators went about their mundane activities as though nothing of importance was happening. Why were they, the people, so perplexed? Well, there could well be more to it. Here's, again, a little bit of the historical background. You see, in 550 BC, Cyrus, the king of Anshan, founded the Achaemenid Empire by conquering the kingdom of Media. And during Cyrus's reign, from 550 to 530 BC, the Achaemenid territory stretched out then from the Balkans to Central Asia. Huge. The Achaemenid Empire was the largest empire by percentage of world population in history. By percentage of world population, the biggest empire in history. Approximately 59 million of the world's 112 million people at the time, that is 44% of the world population, lived under its rule. Why am I telling you this? The thing is this, as well as being the largest and most far-flung, it was also the most diverse and pluralistic empire in the world at the time, unifying different nations, tribes, language, cultures, and religions. And cultural and religious tolerance was one of its clearest and most conscious defining characteristics. Here's the thing. It was an empire built and held together in such diversity, not on an enforced unity created by repression. You couldn't have done it. But on a unity born of remarkable tolerance. Now, how should we have guessed this? One of the most important events that happened during the reign of Cyrus was his defeat of the Babylonian king Nabonidus and subsequent conquest of Babylon. This conquest was important for two reasons. First, it gave Cyrus control of strategic trade routes in the region. Second, it spurred Cyrus to issue a charter. It's known to us as the Cyrus Cylinder because they put things on cylinders, wrote them down. You know, when they wanted them to last, lasting laws. This charter then, the Cyrus Cylinder, proclaimed Cyrus's views on the rights of the nations and people under his rule. And that Cyrus Cylinder, it's a bit of a constitution really. First of all, that piece of, let's say, constitutional law describes how Cyrus and his army had conquered Babylon, defeated Nabonidus, and it then promises freedom of religion and worship for the diverse groups of people living in the Achaemenid Empire. And lastly, the cylinder grants permission to those who were transferred to Babylon as prisoners of war to return to their homeland. Now, of course, one of the groups allowed to return was the Jewish people. We read about that in the book of Ezra. The emperor even gave them financial and political support to return to their homeland, rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. And for these reasons, the Cyrus Cylinder is an important legal document in history, supports religious freedom and tolerance. It was part of the laws, the most fundamental laws, of the Persians and Medes, which cannot be changed. But here is Xerxes I running roughshod over his grandfather Cyrus's cylinder, which was far more than a piece of legislation. It was the very foundation on which the peace and unity of the Persian Empire had been built. And now it was going to be serious for the Jewish people, this thing that Haman had managed to secure, this edict to kill this people group. But the perplexity of the people of this cosmopolitan city of Susa is totally understandable when you realise the seriousness of what these bad boy despots who were now running the show at Susa had just done. It was as if the sky was falling on their heads, let alone on the heads of the Jewish people. It made no sense, even in the context of contemporary politics. It was clearly wrong and unwise, even to contemporaries living outside and watching the political process against the Jews. Doesn't that sound familiar? But all the while, the insecure despots partied on, oblivious to the lack of wisdom and the forces at work in the world that were actually manipulating them. The response of both Xerxes and Haman, verse 15b, here's the contrast. The people were utterly bewildered. The king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was bewildered. So the rulers who just legislated to begin total genocide against God's people saw nothing odd about what they were doing, went back to business as usual, party time at the heart of Persian politics. All the while, they were undermining the cohesion of the Persian Empire. Even the peasants could see the Persian Empire was both out of order and heading for trouble here. And the sense of these two guys, Haman and Xerxes, their sense of ultimately being in control is about to be revealed by their experience in life as the vain illusion that it actually is. Oh, they party on. They have no clue about the realities of the situation. The harem is full of girls, the cellars are full of wine, and look at what bigwigs we are. That's their philosophy of life. Secure in their supposed mastery of doing life. But the citizens of Susa are like the chorus in a Greek tragedy. They see the vulnerability and the fragility of the whole house of cards of such arrogant human life, persecuting the people of God. And there is the citizenry of Susa, as if from the wings on the stage. While downstage front centre, the self-centred, self-righteous and self-sufficient dreamwalk and party on about the actual situation. See, Esther shows us there's a God who is over all and who does work omnipotently but almost silently so that human malice is reversed, as he did on the cross, so that his plans and purposes prevail, guarding the security and the final destiny of his plans and his people. And if you are of his people and are puzzled and perplexed today about what is happening to you and around you, and you don't know how you can fathom it or comprehend it or how you can weather this storm, here's another indication of why this God and why the message of this book of Esther is for you. God bless you. Have a great week.